Hey, this is Dan Squire. The recent news about federal workers has gotten me thinking about the employees of the federal government. What exactly do they do at all the federal agencies? What kind of challenges do they face? What does it mean for Americans if those jobs don't exist anymore? I wanted to ask people directly about the work they've done for America, so I started this program. It's called What I Did for the Government. And the point of the program is to speak with federal workers about the work that they do, how they do it, and how that work impacts Americans. On this program, we'll talk with federal workers about their jobs and experiences working for the government. If you've worked for the federal government, it would be great to speak with you. This is What I Did for the Government. This is Dan, and you're listening to What I Did for the Government. We're talking with Karin Freebird, who worked for the National Park Service and the Bureau of Land Management for nearly 30 years and just recently retired in December of 2024. Thanks for being with us, Karin.
Aloha, Dan. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
How did you get started working for the federal government?
So I grew up in an unlikely place to have this job, but in the beach cities of Southern California, definitely a privileged upbringing, lower middle class family. I mean, we went camping in the Sierras every summer and skiing in the winter. I was a product of a great high school science department who really introduced me to camping in a diversity of locations, the forests, deserts, and even like down into Baja during my high school years. And I was kind of hooked on that. When I was working during college, I worked at the California State Parks in Big Sur, also became an EMT, and eventually graduated from Humboldt State University up in Northern California with a degree in wildlife management and Native American studies.
I appreciate you telling us about your background and what brought you to the federal government. We talked before the show about the variety of positions that you've held over the course of your career. Can you tell us more about the positions that you've held?
Yeah, so once I moved up to Northern California, I got a job with the National Park Service. That was my first federal job with Redwood National Park. And from there, I went to a seasonal academy after working the desk as an interpretive ranger. My days as an EMT and then working behind the desk, I realized I needed a little bit more action and adrenaline junkie. And so I went to Seasonal Academy, a ranger academy. From there, I got my first job as a visitor and resource protection ranger at Rocky Mountain National Park. Spent about a year and a half there. Went to Saguaro National Park as a backcountry ranger down in Tucson, Arizona. Bandelier National Monument in near Santa Fe, north of Santa Fe in New Mexico. And from there, the Smokies, Great Smoky Mountains National Park, the busiest national park in the country. I spent quite a few years there and then transitioned up to Alaska. I missed the West and I traveled north and was the chief ranger at Sitka National Historical Park and then Lake Clark National Park and Preserve. During that time, I had my daughter in Alaska and moved my last position as on a detail to the Appalachian National Scenic Trail. Crosses 14 states and became the chief ranger there for a two-year detail before leaving to go to the Bureau of Land Management. I left in 2019. I retired my law enforcement commission after 21 years and first got a job with the BLM in New Mexico as a monument manager and then really transitioned into kind of my dream job as the National Scenic Historic Trails Program Lead for the Bureau of Land Management.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the last two roles that you mentioned, the role as a monument manager and the role as the National Scenic Trails Program Lead?
Yeah, so monument manager is kind of like a superintendent of a national park, National Park Service, BLM, Forest Service. They have a lot of similar roles and overlap. It would be akin to a superintendent of a national park for those that are familiar with that structure. And it basically oversaw two different areas, El Mapa East National Conservation Area and Kashikatui National Monument, both really diverse and culturally sacred spaces, beautiful landscapes. a lot of issues with visitation, et cetera. And then the National Scenic Historic Trails Program, my time as the chief ranger at the Appalachian Trail, really got me interested and introduced me to the national trail system. And in that role, my day consisted of, you know, budget, policy, and law at like the national level, working for headquarters, coordinating with 15 states that managed or administered 19 of the 32 trails that are in the national trail system. People might be familiar with trails like the Iditarod and Selma to Montgomery, Continental Divide Trail, the Nez Perce Nini Poo or Old Spanish Trail, Pacific Crest Trail. Those are just a few that we managed and or administered. I mean, you can kind of think of them as linear parks.
Karin, you mentioned managing budgets and the need to coordinate with outside agencies and partners. What are some of the additional realities you faced when working in those positions? And what are some of the things that you worked on when managing those places and trails?
Yeah, one of the big efforts in my time was an inventory assessment and monitoring of these trails, which basically means setting up corridors and inventories like baseline. What do we have on the ground and what experiences do we want to protect for future generations? And the National Trail System Act really lays that out. And so coordinating with other agencies that also administer or manage those trails, how we can do so consistently, that was a big part of my work. And then the LAC administration was just unprecedented in their support of Indigenous voices and allowing staff to get creative to do this meaningful work that was really long overdue. So establishing a program called Native Lands National Trails and working with an organization called IANTA, American Indian Alaska Native Tourism Association. It was a big part of the work that I poured my heart and soul into up until the very end in December. So really proud of that work and just really hope that it can continue into the future.
What are some of the challenges that came up as you did that work?
I think challenges, you know, in the different roles that I've had over my career, like rangering and administration, management, a lot of the internal challenges from, you know, different managers and the bureaucracy or, you know, different points of view and trying to collaborate with folks that maybe don't see eye to eye and you know, conflict management, that's a big part of it that kind of overlap both law enforcement and administrative / management of these landscapes. Some of the things, internal challenges that I felt as a ranger and an administrator, I think this is similar to the working public that's outside of the federal government, but lack of support or leaving you to feel like out on a limb sometimes, or when you're a ranger, that kind of can put you at risk. And that happened a lot, especially early in my career. I'd be remiss to not state that there were also some misogynistic issues that I dealt with in my career as a woman rangers, even like teachers and field trainers, bosses, or veteran rangers basically saying that women don't belong in law enforcement. That messaging definitely didn't last in my psyche, but prompted me to often take risks trying to prove myself or gain approval as a younger ranger. Yeah, I think the other challenge that I've seen over the two different types of work that I've done for the federal government is just people managing people without the soft skills or integrity needed to do that in a collaborative way that has kind of stood out.
I appreciate you walking us through your experiences and some of the challenges that you encountered and helping listeners to imagine the realities you experience in those positions. What do you wish that people knew or understood about what it's like to work for the National Park Service or the Bureau of Land Management?
Funding, always, my whole 30 years, has been an issue for the federal government. Everybody wants to do a really great job. These people that work for these federal agencies live and breathe their jobs. They live in the places that people go to vacation. They work and live and become family members, really, with the people they work with. It's a calling that people come to. They often have to move up. Typically, people move every 3 years there's a high rate of divorce, similar to the military, with all the moving that goes on. People bleed. I've heard, you know, bleed green and gray, and then to not be appreciated either by a poor manager or the public or a whole administration. It's really heartbreaking to see. But yeah, working, it's definitely a calling, and it's something that people give their lives to.
I think there are a lot of industries where the line between your work and your personal life is blurred. But in something like law enforcement, people deserve to have the right amount of support and to feel respected and appreciated. I want to ask you about public lands in general. Why are public lands important for everyday Americans?
Yeah, I think these landscapes are globally recognized for their conservation, heritage, recreation, and also multiple use. And so I guess I should clarify, when I say public lands, I'm basically speaking to nearly a quarter of the United States of America is owned by four land management agencies: the National Park Service, the Bureau of Land Management, the Forest Service, the Fish and Wildlife Service. They're set aside with forethought for the American people, for enjoyment, their enjoyment, and the protection of these dwindling wild areas. It was really a forethinking of the people that set up these agencies to protect the resource against urbanization and the westward sprawl that was happening early in the 20th century. And for me, being from Danish descent, like the diaspora of not being on my homeland, and, you know, most of our lineages have migrated to North America from other lands, distant homelands, the public land system provides an opportunity to connect in and to root into something that resonates and is tangible and real if they allow it. So many things have changed over the years since the early 20th century. But what remains the same, I think, is that these places are there for solitude and adventure and subsistence in the form of, you know, hunting and fishing and gathering and providing proven mental, physical, and spiritual health benefits. I think they also are places that promote community building. They celebrate culture, and what everybody should really pay attention to also is they are recognized as multi-billion dollar hubs for economic profit and development when it's done sustainably.
You mentioned that there are four land management agencies that manage about a quarter of the United States. From your perspective, what would it look like if tomorrow those land management agencies were gone?
Yeah, I think we would see high rises and oil fields and windmill farms and solar arrays, and our kids wouldn't have access to wild places. And so it's really important that I don't think anybody wants to see that happen. So that's why, you know, our tax dollars and our voting practices need to support these landscapes.
I think the average person may not understand how much work is needed to properly manage public lands like national parks. For an average person, if they haven't been behind the scenes into the management of a park, it may be difficult to grasp what's involved and how much work is required. Can you talk us through that a little more deeply, into the work that is done that people might not see? And what do our tax dollars pay for when it comes to federally managed land?
Yeah, I did take some forethought on this question, and definitely our tax dollars, when they're spent on public lands, they pay for a lot. There's maintenance workers clearing a trail or cleaning bathrooms, and I think we can all remember COVID when that didn't happen. Bathrooms weren't cleaned. The tax dollars pay for the firefighters, the dispatchers, the pilots. We all so dearly value when it's our house or livelihood on the line. They pay for the kind person behind the desk or the entrance station that gives the direction or education to keep them safe and empower them to connect to the public lands that they're visiting. Pays for the road construction crews, equipment to improve traffic flow during the busy summer season, or infrastructure to accommodate disabilities for your aging parent. Pays for a curator caring for the lineage that I mentioned earlier, that artifacts associated with a diverse nation that can never be replaced once they're lost. It pays for biologists to manage beloved native trout populations, for those of you that are just your people out there. It pays for the management and coordination with state and local federal agencies and organizations that benefit through shared goals and visions, building community, as I mentioned, economic security and jobs that actually get created outside the federal government, like in tourism. And they pay for the rangers that help with all of the above and more. And I did write a piece for this that I'd love to read, Dan, if there's a moment, about rangers and what basically comes from my own experience over my 21 years as a ranger, kind of hit home what rangers do.
You're welcome to, Karin.
Rangers are the ones that answer the call night or day. When your sister has broken her ankle, your child has cactus spines in her hand, your father has had a heart attack, or your brother lies dying of heat stroke or hypothermia on a trail. When a plane has gone down and loved ones are missing or someone drowns. They are the ones wearing the Stetson on horseback in parades, waving to your junior ranger or your inner ranger that you always wanted to be. They are there when an accident happens, when an ancient petroglyph has been stolen from a rock outcrop, a bear threatens your campsite, or a mountain lion attacks. When the windstorm has left you trapped between treefall, elk or bison stop the traffic flow, wildlife or rare plants are poached and sold on the black market, supplies are needed to be packed in by mule into the backcountry. When the roads are unsafe due to snow, your car flips upside down into a river, when your vehicle has been broken into or broken down, or a drunk driver is threatening the safety of everyone, when helicopters need to land, rocks fall, or drug cartels invade, rangers have taken their last breath protecting your safety and that of your family. Rangers, my friends and colleagues, given their lives while stewarding the beauty that makes these places sacred. That's what our tax dollars pay for. I gladly pay mine, and I believe in with every ounce of my being that the majority of Americans want to support all of this work that I just mentioned and might have been misled over the last couple months. So anyway, that's a little synopsis of my thought coming into this conversation and my experiences as a ranger and what our tax dollars go to.
Karin, I really appreciate you sharing that. It's very powerful to think about all of those different pieces that folks are out there doing and that they're risking their lives to do those things to support everyday Americans who are visiting these national parks and other federally managed lands.
Yeah, and I think, you know, maybe the very few that don't go to parks or may disagree with sending their tax dollars, I guarantee you there's like a third degree of separation that somebody they love and care about does enjoy those places and those wild lands. And so thinking of it that way maybe could help bring people together and in their support for these places and the people that work there.
What can Americans with different political views do to come together to protect national parks and other federally managed land in America?
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah, these places that are equally mine and equally yours and the listeners are currently being defunded and brought to their literal knees. And I've seen bipartisan support for these places over my 30-year career, and sure, it ebbs and flows, and we're all accustomed to the whiplash that occurs every 4 years until now it's just unprecedented what's happening the last 7 months, and I don't believe the taxpayers of this country voted for a dismantling of a system that's world renowned and looked to with envy, really, that took over 100 years to build. These folks that the recent firings that we've all heard of, these people dedicate their lives to making these places amazing and usually oftentimes make far less than what's required to live in these rural and or affluent places that people go to vacation. It's already was underfunded. All of these agencies, the Bureau of Land Management, probably the most, just in my recent experience, but literally less than 1% of the entire federal budget, literally less than 1% goes to public lands. And I heard a congressman the other day on some news channel, like he likened it to the ceiling of the room he was sitting in, and the budget for these public lands is a credit card within that space of that room. And while the percentage may seem small, the investments are crucial, right? For everything I discussed a minute ago, the maintenance, the conservation, the economic benefits that they provide through tourism and recreation and resource conservation. And I think the real question that people can ask, and I still don't know the answer to this, is why? Like, I would love an answer. I think we can all give our guess to instill chaos or privatization or extraction, sale to the highest bidder. I don't know what the answer is, but that's something that everyone can do, is ask why, because that's a great question. Why? Why do we want to take 1% of the federal budget? Why is our focus there? And demand answers and get involved and connect with your neighbors and elected officials. And in that collective question lies power. And we've seen it a multitude of times. Decisions can be reversed and these lands can be saved, because once they're lost, they're gone. And so we definitely need to be very sure of what we're doing that can have an impact for decades and decades to come. Yeah.
I really appreciate your perspective on that and thinking through the reality of losing these places to commercial development. In my mind, the value of public lands to Americans is incalculable, and the loss of them is unimaginable.
Crucial.
Speaking as a human being, not as a member of law enforcement, and not as a former federal employee, what, in your opinion, are the most important values for us to have and express as Americans?
Oh, thank you for asking this question. Because first and foremost, I'm a human being. I'm a single mom. I'm a taxpayer. I am all those things. And 4 years ago, when I was working for BLM at the time, and a colleague of mine, a BLM staffer in Colorado, created a video that highlighted an individual named Walter Echohawk. He's a renowned Indigenous author and attorney. And in this video, it's on YouTube, and I can share the link, but he called for a public land and sea ethic. And ever since I saw that video and it was introduced to me, I have not been able to get it out of my head. In that video, he talks about a maturing nation and building a nation. And he said, without moral compass, we can't summon the political, social, economic will to address and solve environmental crisis that threatens human security across the planet. He talks for the need of stewards getting a clear set of core values. It's in line with your questions so wonderfully. A core value that guides the way people look at the ocean and the land. And he even referenced Aldo Leopold, father of the public lands, right? And from 1948, he quoted him to say, no ethic dealing with the human's relation with the plants and animals exists. And we need to decolonize the way we look at the land, from conquerors to members of the community to benefit all. And the values that I hold dear, that I would hope that public land ethic would, land and sea ethic would contain, would be sustainability, integrity. Integrity is like so up front for me. Sustainability, compassion, reciprocity, humility, equity, gratitude. And I think a sacredness needs to be brought back into the work that we do. Unfortunately, these values, all the things that I'm talking about today, it doesn't make any difference if there's not leadership to take us there. And so leadership is definitely a value that, and the right leadership, right? So I think those are the things that I think of as a citizen of this country that I would like to see reborn, if you will.
Karin, I think the values that you mentioned are objectively important for us to consider as Americans. Do you think that a person can learn or reflect on those values when they're visiting a national park or other federally managed land?
Capital YES. Yeah, I think there is no better place. I think the land has a lot to say, a lot to teach us if we would just start paying attention and to listen. I think the earth is trying to tell us something, and we're kind of running out of time, but I think we've all witnessed the fires and the hurricanes and the different things, the sea level rising, and, you know, whether you believe in global warming or whatever science-based thing, there's no way to argue that humans are impacting the earth. And to visit public lands and be in awe of what's before you and have some humility to your place in it all, I think there's no better place to learn those values. That's definitely what I'm teaching my daughter. And I encourage anyone who hasn't done that with their children or their family to get out there and be in awe.
Absolutely. What will it take for the National Park Service and other land management agencies to preserve and protect national parks and other public lands for the next 100 years?
Restore the sacred and those values, I think, first step. I think I mentioned leadership as well. I think thinking in a different way than we've thought before, this land ethic idea. And I know, you know, a lot of people have been talking about efficiency over the last, 7 months, but we do have 4 different agencies that speak to 4 different laws or mission statements, et cetera. I think the public at this point, maybe they do understand the difference or maybe they don't, but as the largest quarter of the country, whether it's Park Service, BLM, Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, all of it, we need leadership to take us together into this land and sea ethic. And for one to survive, I think all would survive. And maybe when you answer to too many different organizations, conflicts can arise and there's not a clear message. I think a clear message that brings all 4 of these agencies under one umbrella for the future and really taking into consideration wisdom, traditions, and previous models of what works and what doesn't work over human history, right, is necessary to get us through the next 100 years and have these places be available to my daughter and her daughter's daughter. That's really important to me.
Thanks for sharing that, Karin. I want to ask you about the motto of National Park Service law enforcement rangers. We talked about this a little bit before the start of the show. Can you share that motto with us?
Yeah, improvise, adapt, and overcome. And I think that's a great message. Every day looked different as a park ranger. And I think that's what drew me to the work, the diversity of never knowing what's going to happen in a day. Adaptability, improvising, and then overcoming. And so I think the resiliency of the federal workers, I think, you know, we got to look for some hope in some areas. And that's definitely a motto that can give you hope that there is a resiliency to this land, to these people, to the earth, all the things that we've talked about today that really hits home. But yeah, improvise, adapt, and overcome gets you through stuff.
Definitely. Karin, after almost 30 years of working in public service and working to protect and serve everyday Americans for the National Park Service and the Bureau of Land Management, you've recently retired. What do things look like for you now that you've retired?
Yeah, well, I'm 7 months in. I did homeschool my daughter for the last, 5 months of it. So that was kind of a job in and of itself. But for me, it's really weird that you do something for your whole like 30 years of your life and then leaving it, and all of a sudden, like, it's full stop. You don't talk about it anymore. So although retiring at the end of 2024 was the best thing I could have done for my mental health and my family, it was really hard leaving behind my friends and colleagues that were suffering anxiety of waiting for the other shoe to drop. And, you know, I knew I made the right decision for myself. But again, it's just this transition of stopping what you're doing so that you've done for so long, right? So when I left service, I was called to revisit my memoir. I started writing for my daughter just after my 50th birthday 2 years ago. I wanted her, I had a really great trip to Scotland and had talked to an elder, and she was like, you need to write down your story and your stories of being a park ranger, et cetera. But to your daughter, so when she's 50, she knows who you are. And so one of the chapters in that memoir that I was really excited to talk to you, Dan, today is just kind of refocusing my call to write the chapters from my ranger time, from my federal government time. And I realize now that, you know, even though I'm not in it every day, I'm taking back my power slowly through creativity and connection. And this is my way forward. Artivism is what they call it. And through my book and telling my story for my daughter and her daughter's daughter, like I mentioned, that's, I think, where my trajectory lies. So we just moved to Kealakekua on the Big Island of Hawaii. It's been a dream of mine. For the first time, I can move where I want instead of where the job is. And so we're taking the remainder of the year to just reset by the sea. We did take a good year to travel the national parks with her fourth grade pass. All fourth graders get into national parks and monuments springy. So that was really fun to do. But it feels good to be here and still and write and have time to reflect. I've got a little side hustle that I've been making quotes with my mom out of Kantha cloth over the last 5 years. So I've got some creativity going on that definitely isn't like akin to working for the federal government, but just love curating photos of women and kids wearing the coats that we make on their adventures, whether like camping, sailing, drinking coffee by fire, or watching the sunrise. We've sold almost like a little over 350 coats over the last 5 years. And let's see what else. I love taking pictures of our adventures and find it kind of like an art form in and of itself, and just a way of expressing my joy and sharing it with my friends and family that I've made in all my travels working for the Park Service. So yeah, I have all of that collected, and who knows where it's going to take me. But if people are interested to follow up on any of that with me, I have a website that I can share. Yeah, it's an exciting time, a different time. Next chapter.
What was your favorite park that you visited? Or what's a favorite memory from the trip with your daughter visiting all the national parks?
Oh, that's a good question. I think one of the favorite things I have that people probably don't, I think people know less about the Bureau of Land Management than they do the National Park Service, but being able to boondock and be out in the middle of the desert in the winter, and the magic of just that isolation and solitude, and being able to open the van doors to the sunrise and not have another person around you for miles, and just really feeling into that wildness. So I'd say that visiting the desert parks, you know, watching my daughter climb rocks and know all the cactuses and that, I would say that was probably my favorite part of this last chapter.
Karin, thanks so much for your time today, for sharing your perspective, and for the years that you spent working to serve the public. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you, Dan. I definitely appreciate the platform and the opportunity as well. I have immense gratitude for you reaching out, and for all my colleagues and friends that are still working and doing the good work, all the organizations that support them, and the public that supports them. So thank you.
Thanks, Karin. Special thanks to Max Rottersman, Ryan Conklin, and Kirsten Hines. To leave a voicemail about the work that you did for the government, please call 405-586-0014. You'll hear,
"Hello, Please state your name after the tone, and Google Voice will try to connect you.
Say your name. You'll hear a few rings, and then go ahead and leave your message.
Hey, this is Dan with the What I Did for the Government podcast. The purpose of this podcast is to help educate people about the importance of federal workers and to help them understand exactly what federal workers do and why that work is important for our country. I set up this voicemail to give people an opportunity to leave a message so they can talk about the work that they did for the federal government and why they feel that work is important. For example, hello, this is Bob. I worked for the U.S. Forest Service for 38 years. I'm very proud of the work that I did there, and we helped protect and manage 250,000 acres of national forest in Central Oregon. You can go into as much detail as you like, but if you have a lot to say, it would be great to have you as a guest on the show. So please, feel free to leave a message. And understand that if you leave a message, I'll likely use that audio from that message for my program. If you'd like to be interviewed on the show, please email me at dan@widftg.com. That's Dan, D-A-N, and W is in whiskey, I is in India, D is in Delta, F is in Foxtrot, T is in Tango, and G is in Golf. Dan@widftg.com. Thank you, and hope you have a good day.